BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to Dialect Radio for Saturday the 23rd of May. This week we hear from a brave young lady who's been working with the medical teams in the besieged region of Gaza. Val Jail is with us too from Bristol's 125 Centre, the charity for women who work on the streets. Journalist and author David Aronovich was speaking at the Arnold Feeney last week, so why were people protesting outside? All that and more coming up with some tunes to keep you going, but first of all, our first feature is about Gaza and the lady who went to work with the medical teams. Eastern Community Centre saw her speak there last week. Evia Shevich has been working with aid agencies, including the Red Cross, in the besieged Palestinian province of Gaza.
My name is Evia Shevich, and I've come here to speak to people in Bristol about the situation in Gaza and how people here can participate in the resistance against Israeli occupation.
So what have you been doing over there?
I'm a co-coordinator for the Free Gaza Movement. I came over on the Dignity boat in early December, and my main task is to coordinate delegations when they come over, but more than that, it's to build relationships with various communities of resistance like paramedics, doctors, and also school kids, university students, really get to know the community and identify twinning opportunities for groups and establishments outside of Palestine to create relationships with groups inside Gaza, to break the isolation.
Yeah, but surely that's already happened. The Gaza war's now finished. I mean, people have seen it on the television. So, I mean, that's over with, surely.
No, the war continues. The siege continues, which is a form of warfare and collective punishment against the 1.5 million inhabitants of Gaza. Shooting from the Israeli occupation goes on daily against farmers and fishermen attempting to fish and make a living in the border areas of Gaza. Extrajudicial killings persist through the use of Apache missiles and surveillance aircraft missiles. So Gaza is still locked down and people cannot go in or out. Students can't fulfill their university placements. Medical patients can't get treatment. And already, according to the Union of Palestinian Medical Relief Committees, 315 people have died in the past 2 years because they couldn't access medical treatment. And of course, there's the psychological war as well, which has been compounded following the massacres of December and January, whereby people are still experiencing a lot of grief, a lot of trauma, and those who've lost their homes and lost family members crushed to death inside their homes can't rebuild those homes. So they're living in tents or they're living in different parts of Gaza with friends or relatives. So whole communities and families have been smashed up.
I mean, isn't the best solution really for Palestinian people simply to move?
Well, this would be the solution that the Israeli occupation would favour, because the Zionist narrative and goal has always been to rid the land that Zionists view as the land for Jewish people, as a Jewish state, to be fully evacuated of Palestinians or Muslims. It's become the case of the colonial project of Israel is continuing and is following the same trajectory that it began prior to 1948, Zionist movement, but still in earnest now as settlements continue to be built in the West Bank, water continues to be stolen, the apartheid wall continues to be constructed, Gaza continues to be constricted as a ghetto. So the ideal solution, of course, is to make it so unbearable that if a border is opened, for example, the Egyptian border in Rafah, people will just leave.
So what can people do here, particularly people who are working in the medical profession?
Well, we're running a campaign at the moment, starting a campaign for all paramedics in Gaza. There are a number of different services, the civil defense, the Red Crescent, the military services, Ministry of Health, and all of these services want to form a union. We had a meeting before we left Gaza, and one of their main issues is to prevent the attacks against their personnel. They lost 16 people during the war. These people were killed by the Israeli occupation. 39 were injured. 15 ambulances were destroyed. And what we want is to push the international community to recognize that Israel has no right, moral or legal, to attack these medical workers, but also to support them through solidarity, through listening to their testimonies, because really these are frontline fighters that are able to convey their witness about the effects of white phosphorus and flechette shells and multiple sniper injuries and the effects of an F-16 crushing a house with its inhabitants in it. You know, the effects of this massive level of violence on the human body, on men, women and children, and these paramedics witness this, and they bear the scars on their own bodies too, and their witness really cannot be refuted. They sign the Hippocratic Oath. They have to help everyone, regardless of religion, regardless of nationality. And they need our support for equipment, for personal protective equipment. They don't have bulletproof vests. They don't have torches. Some of them don't even have reflective vests or the necessary equipment like blood pressure monitors, electric monitors inside the ambulances. So their job is made all the harder by being attacked, but also by not having the right equipment to save people's lives. And I think we have a responsibility to support this community because they are strategically resisting Israel's policy of massacre and mass murder. They're saving the lives that Israel wants to kill, and they're saving the community in the process, because the health of the community can be promoted by the fact of members of the community and family members not dying, because every death is massively traumatizing for the whole family and the community.
Now, a lot of people listen to this also on the internet. Is there a website people can go to find out more?
They can go to freegaza.org. There's lots of links to different blogs there.
That was Evia Savic, who was talking at the Eastern Community Centre last week. And you can find out more, as Eva mentioned, at www.freegaza.org.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
I'd like to welcome into the studio now the poet in residence, the bard of Windmill Hill. He's whispering the words at me just in case I forgot. His name is Trevor. Hello.
Hello. Hello, John. Good to be here.
Excellent. Yeah, we've had you on before, so it's very nice to welcome you back. We had some excellent poetry from you before.
Thank you.
I suppose to start off, really, I understand you're a bit of a zeitgeist poet. We had a bit of current affairs just then. Have you written anything in relation to the seismic events of the week?
I certainly have. Well, as it so happens, I wrote something only last night.
Right.
Yeah. And it's a rather severe message, I have to say, because there's a lot of people, you know, complaining about the rot at the heart of our nation.
Mm.
But I'm actually, this is called Indicted Nation.
Right.
So I'm actually thinking the essence of it is that, in fact, we're all responsible. And part of my thesis is that, you know, but part of the underlying problem is that we've become consumers rather than citizens. I'm also a sort of student of I've studied politics and history, so this is
okay.
This kind of informs my poetry. So it's a bit of a heavy message, I have to say, that I'm giving out here. Would you like to hear this?
Yes, I would very much so. Yeah.
Indicted Nation. I write of the recent aggravation relating to expenses, and to indict a careless nation and question its pretenses. We revel in our indignation and express profound dismay. We lament upon the situation. Why have MPs gone astray? We tinker with our constitution and uphold our House of Lords. We always seek the soft solution, as our history records. We wouldn't welcome revolution. It is not the British style. But now we're seeking restitution from our MPs' lies and guile. The sleazy deeds are now apparent as cooked books are put on view. Now we demand they be transparent and reveal what's sadly true. We gave green lights to the secrecy, casting votes for red or blue. And yet now mock the democracy that we've clung to through and through. We get the systems we deserve. We all should share the blame. We've been too ready to preserve a complicated game. We all need our hypocrisies, so let's not shout too loud. The state of our kleptocracy hangs like a toxic cloud.
You are including the word kleptocracy in a poem as a rhyme. You are a politics student, I can tell. There's definitely
yeah.
What is kleptocracy?
A kleptocracy is a system whereby the people running it are all sort of on the take and on the make, really.
So, oh, so that's what
so it's kind of every man for every person for themselves. Really.
Okay. Yeah. That seems to be sort of the system. It occurred to me today, system is every man for himself, and then the job of running the country is supposed to kind of come about as a sort of side effect of everybody sort of following their own ambition.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it kind of overstates the case to some extent, you know. So, I mean, poetry is always something of an exaggeration, but...
Okay.
But I do, I mean, generally, I don't seriously believe that most people go into politics to, you know, to make money or to rip off the system. But it's more or less putting across that we've slid into the situation because of this sort of the general laxness of, and a general, as I say, a general inclination not to avoid anything too radical.
Okay, so you do see some hope, as you ended the poem on a very potent note about the toxic cloud, but you do see some hope, not all.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how it all shakes out. You know, I think there's just listening to the news tonight, there's a kind of mood in the air that, you know, people may consider changes that that they haven't thought about, and some people have been contrasting it to 1832, with the Reform Act of 1832.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, There could be a serious shake-up. I'd like to think there is, you know.
So you're keeping your pen and paper close at hand?
As ever, yes.
Yes, as ever. Yeah. Now, you're part of an event, co-organising.
Yes.
Something that's called Cabaret. Tell me a little bit about this.
The South Bank Cabaret. Well, we've done these shows every few months. We've done one last year at the South Bank Centre in Dean Lane, Southville. We've done quite a few at the Lansdowne Pub,
okay,
in Clifton, and we've got a two-night run next weekend, 29th and 30th, at the South Bank Centre, Dean Lane. So tickets are available from the Grant Bradley Gallery on Bedminster Parade.
The Grant Gallery on Bedminster Parade.
Grant Bradley Gallery, Bedminster Parade. Yeah.
Okay.
So you can get your tickets from there, Friday or Saturday.
Why is it called Cabaret? What is the theme? What's
it's kind of
what will people see there?
It's kind of an old-fashioned variety show, really, because it's something quite different. So it's not that easy to sell. But what I'm being encouraged by is a lot of people who came to the last one, which sold out. We could have actually got a lot more people in. We turned away a lot of people, so we're going for a two-night run. But a lot of people who've been before us are booking to come back because they really enjoyed it. This is completely different. Nobody's doing anything like this, because you've got circus, you've got music, you've got dancing girls, you've got magic, you've got poetry, you've got really virtually everything in one show.
The young man in me definitely did notice that you said dancing girls, just to repeat that.
I did repeat, dancing girls. I am assured that we will have...
Excellent.
We can.
And you will be performing poetry there?
I will be doing my bit, yes.
Okay. Yeah. I like the fact that you're wearing a black hat in particular. You're keeping your head warm. You're keeping your brain heated up and ready for action at all times.
Yes, yeah. Well, this isn't my... I have a different hat that I wear for my cabaret. It's not my cabaret hat.
Okay. You have a sheet of paper in front of you which has when... dot dot dot.
When, yes, yes.
What is the...
Well, the nation's favourite poem is said to be If.
Okay.
Yeah, which you've... Rudyard Kipling's If.
Yes.
In fact, that's out of date. The question is no longer if, but when. So this is... Well, it's just... It's called when. Would you like to hear this?
Yep.
When. When you're feeling indecisive, when you're neither out nor in, when your world appears derisive, when you feel that you can't win, when your vocal cords are tongue-tied, when you have nothing left to say, when you're sitting on the outside, when no one has come out to play, Do not dwell on your dilemmas. Do not complain. What use is this? Forget about those passing tremors. Consider my hypothesis. We are enriched by entertainment that sees life in a different mode. It makes us ponder our arrangement as we meander our life's road. Our circus is an inspiration. Perhaps you've seen us in the news. Our music is a sound sensation to medicate the winter blues. Jokey stand-ups mock pretensions about the things we do and see. Poets offer new dimensions as versatile as verse can be. Magicians are a source of wonder, tricks to amuse you and amaze. So missing out would be a blunder. Our cabaret is set to blaze.
Thank you very much. Just remind us when the cabaret is.
Next weekend, the 29th and 30th.
29th, 30th of May, and that's at the South Bank Centre.
South Bank Centre.
Which is at Dean Lane in South Bank.
It's an 8:30. The show will start from 8:30.
Okay.
Doors will open about 7:30.
Exactly. And the tickets
and
are...
tickets are available at the Grant Bradley Gallery on Bedminster Parade. Ask for Albany.
Okay. And how much are tickets?
Tickets are a mere £7.
£7. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next feature is from Daleks reporter Anthea Page. It's an interview with Val Giel, MBE, founder of the 125 charity, which supports vulnerable women on the streets of Bristol. In this interview, Val tells us how the charity was formed.
I'm Val Giel, and I'm the founder of 125. And the project started in 1995. And it really came about as something. I was already working for the Salvation Army in St Paul's. I was the community manager there for the Candle Project, which is a project working with homeless men and women. But the majority of users there were men, and I noticed that during the 5 years I was working there, that there were women selling sex from the street who were not accessing our services. And I think that was chiefly because it was perceived to be a male-orientated sort of drop-in. And so I approached the women on the street and I asked them what would help them in their lives, not necessarily to come out of prostitution, but what would help them. I took a questionnaire to 35 women. And the result of that very small questionnaire was that unanimously they said they wanted a women-only space, a drop-in just for them. Over about a year, I had been having, so that was 1994, 1995, I'd been having talks with the staff in the sexual health clinic at the Bristol Royal Infirmary and talking to them about the needs of these women. I'd talked to the women, and it seemed that they weren't able to access the services of the BRI at that time because of the clinic times being sort of between 9 and 5, and because of the chaotic lifestyle of the women, it was very difficult for them to access the clinic. And one doctor there, senior doctor, Dr. Dorothy Milne, she, around that time, retired from the sexual health clinic, and we started talking, and she became really quite interested in setting up a drop-in for the female sex workers. I'd also talked to an Anglican nun called Sister Annalise, who is a sister with the community of the Sisters of the Church, and they live and work from 82 Ashley Road. And Annalise had just arrived in Bristol, and I asked her if she would be interested in working with us to set up a separate project to work with the women. And she said that she would be interested. At the same time, and this all kind of happened within a few months really, another nun arrived in Bristol. She was going to be living in the Movement for Faith and Justice Today, in Cottam, and she was Sister Mary, and she's a Catholic nun. Annalise is an Anglican nun. And I went and spoke to Mary and sort of explained to her what we were doing, and she also decided to join us. And so there we were, four women with a desire to reach out to these women, but not a huge amount of know-how, actually. I then was pretty well burnt out from working in the Candle Project, went off to work in Chicago for a month, working in a safe house for women, for female prostitutes. And that was an amazing time. And during that month, I knew with certainty that I needed to be coming out of the Candle Project and devoting my time and energy into setting up the project with the women. At the same time, the man who was leading the faith and the movement for faith and justice today, who lived at 1B at Sydenham Road, offered us the basement of their property, which actually the address of which was 125 Cheltenham Road. And so he offered us the basement. So we four women were able to open a drop-in there. So that's how the name came about, rather an odd name, 125, and the women chose it. They said, yeah, it didn't mean anything to anybody, and so they went for 125. So I came back from Chicago, I resigned from the Candle Project, and in June of 1995 opened the drop-in at 125 Cheltenham Road. Now obviously, starting a new project, there was no money, we didn't have a bean. We didn't have a sheet of paper, we didn't have a pencil, we didn't have any money. And so I was unsalaried. I appointed myself as the project development worker at that time, but unsalaried. And we set about bringing around us people who had got experience of working with the women. So we approached Bristol Drugs Project, and they very kindly agreed for their outreach worker to come to our drop-in once a week and to act as a consultant. So we set up a committee, and Marie came and joined us. We also approached the health advisors at the sexual health clinic at the BRI, and they also agreed for a health advisor to come to us once a week and be, as an advisor, and to be on our advisory committee. And we also had someone, Anne Colquhoun, from another sort of community-based National Health Service, and she also was extremely helpful in helping us in those early days to set up. And so we took advice from people. I should have said that prior to actually starting this, we checked out that there was no one else in the city who was primarily working with the female sex workers. So that's how 125 came into being. Our first donation of £5 was given to me by a very dodgy character who lives still. And he used to let out his flat as a kind of, it became a crack house and a place where the women could take punters to work. And he came to me one day when I was doing outreach in St Paul's and said, you're doing a good job there, girl. And he squeezed a fiver into my hand. So we opened a bank account with that fiver.
So now, Val, there's a lot of respect for your organisation from local people, isn't there?
Yes, there is. And we've had to earn that respect, because initially we were viewed with suspicion, and were we just attracting the women into the area? So we've had to earn the respect, and we've had to earn the respect of professionals as well.
Is that the police?
The police, the health authority, the drugs projects. You know, we've had to earn that respect, because initially we were just seen as a bunch of do-gooders.
And are you the only organisation like this in the country, do you know?
No, we're not. And there are, through the National Christian Alliance on Prostitution, which has now recently changed its name to Beyond the Streets, there are at least 47 projects that are across the country similar to 125. But we were one of the very early ones. And in fact, 125 has helped a number of those projects to set up. We've been able to share our experience, our mistakes, and some of the things that have worked. So we've helped other projects to start up.
And how has it changed over the years?
Well, it's grown, of course. It's grown hugely. And from those early days of just having a small drop-in where maybe we'd have maybe two, maybe three people, women coming in a week, and maybe only one might come, you know, we now have sort of up to 20 in a day coming to the drop-in, and we are actually in touch with around 200 different women. So it has grown hugely. But, you know, I should say that it's grown chiefly because of the outreach. So until we were able to, until we had the gift of a van, a local church, Cornerstone Ministries, gave us quite an elderly poor transit van, but that transformed the project. Because then we were able to go out on the street to meet the women where they were.
What importance is the food aspect of the van?
Oh, it's vital. We started off just taking chocolate cake and coffee and tea, but we very quickly came to realise that the women were very hungry, that for some of them that might be the only food in the day. And so we quickly started taking out sandwiches and chocolate bars and fruit and a cold drink, as well as the hot drinks and the homemade cake wherever possible. But for many women, that is the only food they have. So they look out for the van and they're so grateful to have the food. And so we try to give them nutritious food. Sandwiches are always, you know, healthy sandwiches. The fruit, two pieces of fruit each night. And you see, 99% of the women we work with have an addiction to Class A drugs. So the money goes on the drugs. And many of those women have partners, and the partners also have a habit. And so they have to provide for two drug habits. So all the money goes on the drugs. So they are hungry and malnourished.
So does the drug stop them from feeling hungry anyway?
No, it doesn't. But their first concern is because they feel so ill if they don't have the drugs. So, you know, it's a really complicated business. Their health is very poor, deep vein thromboses, and obviously sexually transmitted infections, but, you know, their physical health is very poor, and also their mental health. They become depressed and they become isolated. So they're very isolated in our community. And of course they suffer violence on the streets from punters, from the general public.
So the drop-in centre, there's a medical person?
Once a week we have a doctor who comes and she is able to examine the women, to treat them immediately if they have problems. There's also a GP service once a week, so the GP is able to identify problems and to give treatment. A police officer comes once a fortnight and holds a surgery in total confidence. And, you know, that's very helpful for the women. We have a really good relationship with the police. They've been excellent and very supportive, so that when women are raped or attacked, they pursue the perpetrators of the crime and bring them to justice. And, you know, we're really pleased with that.
You've just had an award, I believe.
Yes, we've just had a very good award, a health award, Health of the Nation. Helen, our development manager, and Josie, our fundraiser, they went to London yesterday to receive their cheque. So, you know, nationally we are recognised now as being a leader, really, in the field of providing support to these very vulnerable women.
That was Anthea Page talking to Val Giel, MBE, founder of the 125 charity that supports vulnerable women in the streets of Bristol. And, of course, they won an award from the Prince's Trust, and we had somebody in last week, if you are an eagle-eared listener. If you want to support this charity, join them on the night walk at 8 p.m. on the 13th of June, which is the 13th of June, leaving from the Ark Cottam Road, South Bristol. To find out more, log on to www.justgiving.com/125nightwalk That's 125 Night Walk, O-N-E, and the number 2 and the number 5. Just to slightly confuse things. The thing for this year's popular walk is summertime, so lots have a chance to have some fun, get there and dress up. Great for families and kids, or you can get a group together from your office.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Or go onto our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Welcome to the studio, a kora player called Musa Koyati. Hello.
Hello.
A kora is a famous West African harp.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about how you got started with the instrument.
Yeah, this instrument is my spirit because I have it from my ancestors. It comes down in my family for since 1235, that's about 800 years.
Yeah.
And more longer than that even. We've been advisors and choral players in the royal court of Mandi. That was Sunjata's time.
So you've always known this instrument since you were born?
Yeah.
Describe to listeners who can't see the kora, tell us a little bit about the kora and what it looks like and what it's made of.
It's made of calabash, and the body is a calabash, like big pumpkin, and it's covered here by cow skin.
Okay.
And I have mahogany as the neck and...
and the sort of the hand grips.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my bridge is ebony, and yeah.
And it has, how many, 21 strings?
22 strings.
22 strings, yeah. Okay. And it has, I'm looking at it now, it has one set of strings on one side, so you've got 11 on one side and 11 on the other.
Yeah.
And you play it with just the first finger in your thumbs on both sides.
Yeah.
Okay. Would you like to play us a tune?
That would be lovely.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
That's really peaceful. It's just the most peaceful music I think I've ever heard to listen to choral music.
Thank you. That's lovely.
I understand we asked you earlier on if you sort of did any gigs. I understand you sort of tend to do an awful lot of private gigs.
Yeah.
But people find you by busking. So how does that?
I have my where by I have contacts. I give my contacts away from small gigs I do around and to, pubs.
Mm.
And yeah, and then I have BBC. I have I'm part of the PRS. I'm a musician.
Yeah.
And and I go out for busking.
Okay, where do you tend to, where can people sort of probably see you busking in town?
Yeah, they see me busking.
Whereabouts?
It's about Le Poirot Bridge.
Le Poirot Bridge, that's the one with the big
horns
on, by the picture and piano.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Do you have a website address at all? Are you on the internet?
Yeah, it's www.cora.cora.me.uk.
Cora Me.
Yeah.
So that's K-O-R-A M-E.
Yeah.
Dot
UK.
UK.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like Cora.me.uk.
Cora.me.uk.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you very much for coming in. It's genuinely been a privilege to have you come in and play your instrument. It's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah. It's nice to play.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
The actor Malcolm Grieve, who as ever is reading our instalments of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill, is away filming Doctor Who at the moment in Cardiff. It's all top secret, we understand, so we don't know a thing. He does, though. But he still found time for another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary. This is a story about a guy who's never been an innkeeper before. He signs up to run the Spread Eagle Inn in Tame in Oxfordshire. And this is his diary that he kept in the 1920s and 30s about how he got on.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. The commercials. Commercial travellers have been spoiled by their having hotels kept on purpose for them. They have been numerous enough to be worth spoiling for their custom and drinking, or at least treating capacity. Our mineral waters traveller told me he still has to give over 25 shillings a day in drinks. But now they stay no longer in the little places, but do their rounds in a car from only the biggest towns. For those who asked for blanket beds, we used to keep a pair apart, bringing them out when wanted. Once, a commercial came and, of course, asked for a steak. I said, "I've some very good saddle of mutton and jugged hare. Wouldn't you have that for a change?" "No, I want a steak." "But I don't keep steaks, and if I got you one, I know it'd be very tough." "Look here, I've had a steak 5 days a week for 30 years, and I want a steak now, if you please." "But I don't please. I guarantee it will be utterly tough." "Never mind, I'll have it." I had tried to save him and the reputation of the place even amongst commercial travellers, so now I went to the butcher's and asked for the toughest piece of steak out of the freshest animal he had, and between us we got a beauty. It seemed almost illegal. I felt like Mr. Tasker. I didn't see him again, but he told the parlourmaid he'd had to leave half of it. Once I sent a commercial up to a little timber room that we had just discovered and beautified. He looked at it and said, "Well, I'm used to a certain modicum of comfort." And then he poked the bed. Katie Lomas said, "You needn't do that." And then he asked if this was the only hotel in town, and she said there was another, and he'd better go to it. And he did. Soon after that, I took up to the same room a funny-looking little businessman. "Well, it's a curious room." "What's the matter with it?" "Oh, it'll do for the night." "Probably it is one of the prettiest rooms you will ever have slept in." "Is Aylesbury far from here?" "No, quite near." "Are there any hotels?" "Yes, lots. But they are normal, and this is abnormal." "I'll take off my boots," he said with a good smile. His bill was enormous, and he insisted upon my sharing with him a bottle of fizz before he left at 11 o'clock the next morning. One of the old regime rolled up in a car and demanded a number. When I told him the house was full, as indeed it was, he flew into a rage and shouted that he'd been here for 40 years and never known it so before. I accepted the compliment. in proud humility. But though we did the commercials well and charged low and gave them clean sheets and were polite, they never came twice. Hotels are their homes, so they're naturally particular about their atmosphere. Only two survive. Nice people, and they come with appalling regularity. Mr. Paul of Spillers and Bakers, who reads good books, and Mr. Rose of Peter Ryland's. So, gone the furniture and Freemasons, gone the farmers, commercials and charabancs, and dead three customers at the bar, who brought us in £800 between them. Yes, and customers that we had taken over in the valuation, dead within 3 years. If only I'd insured their thirst at Lloyd's. We had now lost almost all we had paid so extortionately for, and had to form a policy whereby we could be of service to some other section of the community. 1923 to 1924, the new style begins. Wilson Steer came to stay for his summer's painting, and Monty Pollock sent George Berend here for the same purpose. Without one another's company, I don't know what they would have done, because there are no subjects here, and the weather was worse. Anyhow, in 5 to 6 watercolours, Steer created for the first time grandeur for this open town and marketplace. One evening, to relieve the monotony, I told Steer that we'd had a baby just born. He looked very frightened at first, and then asked, "Is that true? I didn't know it could be done so quietly." God knows what he expected. And it was done cheaply as well. For when Dr. Summerhayes sent me his bill of £7, I told him that he had acted under false pretences, for if I'd known it was to cost only that, I'd have had twins. It was cold, and Mr. James Hawkins opposite did a brisk trade with Steer in waistcoats. The following year, when they were at Long Crendon nearby, it's good to think that it was here that Steer and George Berend founded their summer friendship, which has lasted to this day. I told Steer that he had shocked the proud artistic inhabitants by painting an ugly and the only new house in this Mrs. Allingham village. And he replied, "But it's the only thing in the village to paint." Or was it just that it happened to be the only thing to be seen from his front door? Berend is incredibly industrious in spite of his doing such good work. Next year, Steer wrote from Bridgnorth, "Berend has just received a letter from Balmoral couched in these terms. Dear Mr. Berend, the King has heard with much pleasure and interest of your unique achievement in painting 12,700 watercolours, thus exceeding the number painted by the late A.W. Rich, and also attaining a further record of 1,400 watercolours in one season. His Majesty warmly congratulates you upon these remarkable feats, whereby you have established a new and greater record in the history of your national art. Most very truly, Stamford Bridgnorth." N.B. Whilst Berend was doing his last two watercolours at Bridgnorth, he was in possession of a four-leafed clover. Sent him for luck. The year after that, Berend wrote from Shoreham, "We have no news, as we have barely recovered from grief at the failure of Steer's recent attempt to swim the channel. He started full of buck, and was in the water exactly 2 seconds when, owing to the excessive choppiness of the channel, he regrettably returned to the beach, where he partook of a hearty meal and redonned his waistcoats." And yet, it was Steer who got the Order of Merit later, and not Berend. Henry Tonks came the next summer, and though beaten for subjects like the others, stayed on out of his goodness, and painted and presented me with a panel in the dance room, experimenting with every known and unknown medium. When Tonks dies, I shall really feel that the population of the world is one less. To a farmer at the market day ordinary, whilst watching him carving an entire calf's head, jaws, teeth and all, I remarked, "Isn't it strange that with a calf's head, which is such soft and easily masticated stuff, there should be provided a complete set of teeth to eat it with?"
Thank you very much to Malcolm Greaves ever for reading our latest instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Journalist David Orlovich has a new book out, Voodoo Histories, attempts to debunk many conspiracy theories. But
Has Aronovich got which theories are wrong and which theories are right? Right. Protesters gathered outside the Arnold Fini last week to voice their opposition to his throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Hi, my name is Ingrid and I'm here to stand for my rights. My rights as an individual and to confront this man, David Aronovich, which is, with his new book, Voodoo Histories, where he's trying to whitewash all conspiracies together. I think that's out of order, especially if he's making money out of it, because there's actual evidence in many of these conspiracy theories that he's going on about. Mounds and mounds of evidence. Just look at 9/11. Start with 9/11.
Well, yeah, but he's got every right to write a book about this subject, hasn't he? And, I mean, he sees a lot of these theories as nonsense.
Yeah, well, he's got his own right to his own opinion, you know, so that is true to say. But it's not fair to use the main media. People are going to be watching this on the main media and they're going to believe him when he's not being correct. He's not giving the correct information out there, because there is evidence to prove many of the things that he's debunking. So much evidence, you just got to look out there.
So are you going to go and confront him with some of this?
I myself, it's £6 to get in, and unfortunately I am not going to pay £6 to go in there and just to confront him, but I have got friends here that are going to go in, are going to confront him, and I'm out here just giving my support, my moral support out here whilst they go and confront him and debate with him, yes.
My name's Paul Chedzi, and I'm part of the Ninja Hippies, member of the group, and I saw something on Facebook. Well, they advertised it, so I thought I'd come along and see what it was about. Because
what are the Ninja Hippies?
They are a free party group. They put on free parties for information about, well, basically trying to bring out the truth about how society works and that, and trying to change things. So I thought I'd just come along and, instead of paying lip service to it, actually do something for a change, basically.
I'm Tony, and I'm here because I saw the clip on the news with Mr. Aronovich trying to sort of debunk conspiracy theories, and I've just had a look through his book as well and read some of the evidence, like the evidence to do with the plane crashing into the Pentagon, and he sort of very matter-of-factly seems to point out and say that witnesses identified wreckage in an engine, and I've seen evidence to the contrary and seen the engine that was towed out of the Pentagon, and it definitely doesn't fit, and I've seen the evidence to say it's not the Rolls-Royce engine that they're suggesting it is. So he's sort of very matter-of-factly putting across evidence that has already been proved to be false and trying to use that evidence to disprove people's accusations that the evidence he's presenting is false, you know. So it's kind of like a very backwards way that the information is being presented, just from how I've just had a quick glance at that myself. So
I mean, he's entitled to his view, isn't he? And he's entitled to publish a book about what he says.
Of course he's entitled to his view, as everybody's entitled to his view, but we are trying to appeal to him as the human being, because he must know that he's wrong. You know, in his soul, he'll know that he's wrong. So that's the point we're really trying to make, because we know we're right with what we're saying and what we're standing up for, that there's something iffy about it. The official explanations don't tie up. There should be another investigation into it to try and sort of take into account the real evidence that people are presenting. You know, and until that's been done, then we're not going to be happy. So we're going to stand up, and we want to stand up for the truth and the fact that these things need to be investigated, and we need to be given a more satisfactory explanation as to what's happened.
Well, his new book, Voodoo Histories, it looks at lots of different conspiracy theories, and it's basically saying that a lot of this is nonsense. I mean, surely that's true, because there's lots of disinformation out there.
There's loads of disinformation, and there's loads of people who are entitled to their opinions, as is everybody else. And you know, people can come up with, they can be blaming it all on the Jews, or they can be blaming it all on Satanists and this one, and everybody's got some kind of wild theory. But the most wild theory I seem to see is the official explanation. That seems to be the most wild conspiracy theory out there. So I'm not going to stand up and say that any one of these conspiracy theories, as we're calling them, is true. But most definitely, I will go against the official explanation that we're being given as being the truth. The truth lies somewhere in between.
So what about, which do you think is the most staggering lie that's being told, and you actually believe the conspiracies rather than the official story?
Well, the JFK, for instance, like with him being shot from the back of the head from the Texas Book Depository, and yet we're shown a film of the front of his head exploding and his head going back. The guy was shot from the front. He definitely wasn't shot from the back by some magic bullet that went in the back of his head and then went and turned these different degree turns and managed to make all these holes in his body and end up within the driver. It's just total wild conspiracy theory that we've been given, and the fact that they've never gone in and actually tried to investigate it properly and take into account the evidence. So that's probably the most wild claim that I've heard of myself.
I'm Andrew Kelly from the Bristol Festival of Ideas.
Yeah, and What is it about Mr. Aronovich you think makes him worthy of a man of great ideas?
I think it's a very well-researched book. It's passionately written, and like all the authors we have here, it's a delight to have them as ever.
So what will he be talking about this evening?
He's covering what's in the book, what he talks about, what underpins conspiracy theories, some of the examples that he's got, the moon landing, I'm sure, and Kennedy and so on. And
but don't you think there's a problem in that he's muddying the waters by mixing up some real cover-ups and deceptions with the sort of crazy alien type theories?
Well, I think he's covering a very broad range, and that's it, you know. Have you read the book, Tony? I'm very pleased to have it. You know me, always up for debate.
Protesters there who gathered last week outside the Arnolfini to disagree with David Aronovich's view that those who doubt the official 9/11 story are mad conspiracy theorists. And thank you to Tony Gosling for that contribution. Anything to do with conspiracy theories is generally from him.
Your planet, your rights.
I've got that written on this piece of paper in very big letters. And very true it is too. An MEP Question Time event. This leaflet has been given to me by Tim Elliott of Amnesty International, who dropped this in and will be coming in to chat to us in a couple of weeks. It's a Question Time event where you get to chat and ask questions to members of the European Parliament, or our candidates for the members of the European Parliament, I should say, the South West Euro candidates, on how their party's elected MEPs will represent these vital issues in the European Parliament should they become elected, in due course, of course. Climate change, human rights and international development is the thing. It's on Wednesday the 27th of May, 7.30 to 9pm. The doors open at 7. There is food and drink available when you get there. It's at the Watershed Media Centre, which is at Cannons Road, Bristol, which is right on the waterfront. As I say, food and drink available from the bar. Candidates on the panel are Ashley Fox of the Conservatives, Ricky Knight of the Green Party, Keir Dillon of Labour, Kay Barnard of Liberal Democrats and Dr Julia Reid of UKIP. And the chair is Bob Constantine, former ITV West political editor. You can send your questions to yourmepquestions@googlemail.com or check out the discussion board at www.ecojam.org. And for further information, visit bristolfo.org.uk. Tim Elliott of Amnesty International, thanks again, and he'll be dropping in a couple of weeks to chat about how that went. Now over to a bespectacled man with a t-shirt that says Rock and Roller on a sort of pun of the Rolls Royce t-shirt, 2 R's, in a leather jacket. Hello, how are you?
Fine, thanks, John. Good evening, this is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday 29th of May, and the Suspects will be performing at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 PM and tickets are £7 in advance. Also on 29th of May, DJ Derek and Friends will be performing at the Lanes in Bristol. The event starts at 9 PM and entry is £5 on the door. Moving on to Song of the Week, and I feature The Hopeless Abandoned. This band hail from South West Wales and have been active since last year. This is from their self-titled EP and is a song called Swear to God.
Running in the breeze to save my soul.
That was The Hopeless Abandoned with Swear to God from their self-titled EP. For more information, you can check out www.thehopelessabandoned.com and also www.myspace.com/hopelesspunks, that's spelled P-U-N-X. Moving on to Saturday, 30th of May, and the Travelling Band will be performing with support from Clay Faces at the Thunderbolt in Bristol. Doors open at 5 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance and £5 on the door. Also on 30th of May, The Blockheads, Zion Train, The King Blues and Dub from Atlantis will be some of the acts performing at the Bristol Vegan Fair. Tickets are £8 in advance for adults and £4 in advance for under 12s and are available from Bristol Ticket Shop. On the day, entry is £10 before 5 p.m. and £12 after. On to Sunday, 31st of May, Mostly Autumn will be performing at the Guildhall in Gloucester. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance and £17 on the door. Finally, on 31st of May, Jazz Reggae Sessions will be at the Carnation Tap in Bristol. It starts at 4 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. And also a reminder, Trevor the Bard of Windmill Hill came in earlier. The South Bank Cabaret is on the 29th and 30th of May. Doors open at 7:30, performance at 8. It is a cabaret, so you'll have an evening of circus, magic, comedy, music and poetry. Oh, and dancing girls. Very important that we remember that. Right, time for my gabbling to cease, because that's all for this week's show. It's time up. Dialect is a community internet radio station broadcast on the web at www.dialectradio.co.uk and at www.bcfm.org.uk, as well as on BCFM airwaves at 93.2 across the city of Bristol at 9 p.m. on Saturdays and 8 p.m. on Sundays. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production and anyone can contribute. So if you're sitting around, you live in Bristol and you want to just come along and see what we do and see if you think you could contribute, then come along, please do in any way, either in reporting or engineering, presenting. Do get in touch via Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. Or you can find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Thanks to our studio guest, Musa. He's brilliant. He's going to be at Glastonbury Festival, and he does busk a lot by the bridge with weird horns on in the middle of town by the Pitcher and Piano pub. Reporters this week were Anthony Page and Tony Gosling. Thank you to Trevor the Bard of Bristol, Windmill Hill, I should say. And studio production was by Tony Gosling. The producer was Tony Gosling, and studio engineering was by Villas Chukurin, who's been back from a holiday in Tokyo. Lucky man. Well, that was Dialect, and this is John wishing you a very good week from all the team in the Queen Square studio in Bristol. Thank you very much for joining us, and take care of yourselves. Toodle-pip.